I know you have. And you've got to do what you've got to do. Officially speaking, though, I haven't said shit. And you have not been tasked. You got that? Got it. The connection crackled for a few seconds. Cord, old buddy, I've got a ribeye staring me down here. I'll let you get back to your steak. Sorry to bother you. You kidding? Between you and me, this little phone call has made my week. Guess that means you've had a shitty week. I'd say you have no idea, but you probably do. Hanley sipped water now. Your mom misses you. Suzanne Brewer's definitely not my mom, and I doubt she misses me. She probably was hoping I hadn't checked in because I got hit by a bus. Brewer knows she's not that lucky. Hanley laughed aloud, then adopted an authoritative tone. I want to hear back from you again, soon. You copy? We still have an arrangement, if you remember. Copy. Let me figure out my current predicament, then I'll reach out. Put a couple weeks in between, Hanley said, for the sake of plausible deniability. Will do. Hanley added, I guess I'll keep an eye on the news for a few days to see what the hell you're up to. Be careful, kid. Come through whole, okay? I'll do my best. Hanley disconnected the call and immediately put a call into a number he had stored on his phone. It went directly to a desk at the Pentagon, and a watch officer answered on the first ring and sent Hanley's call on from there. While he waited for the transfer, he picked up his fork and took a bite of his sherry-glazed mushrooms. As he looked around the room, it occurred to him that no one else sitting in the restaurant could have possibly guessed that the thickly built man dining alone had just given tacit approval to the assassination of the president of Syria. Chapter 66. Court Gentry sat alone in Captain Anderson's hooch for 20 minutes, drinking water, eating rations, and waiting. A Green Beret medic came in and cleaned and stitched the vicious cut he'd received over his right ear from the exploding windshield glass in Damascus, then wrapped Court's head with a dressing. Finally, the captain came through the door, followed by two other members of his A-team. He introduced them as Danny, a master sergeant, and Cliff, a first sergeant. Court did not introduce himself, but shook their hands. Once this was done, Robbie said, All right, mystery man. I've been told to hand you over whatever you want, equipment-wise, food-wise, and water-wise, etc., and follow your instructions. I am then ordered to forget I ever saw you. Not sure if that means you have friends back at Langley, or enemies.
Yeah, our relationship status is complicated,
Robbie said.
We are staying here for the next several weeks, so unless you want to join our op, you'll need to get extracted somehow. If your friends in high places can scare up transport for you, I'll certainly get you safely to your LZ.
Court shook his head.
Thanks, but I don't need babysitters.
Sir, you're smack dab in what's left of ISIS country.
Well, that blows. My travel agent said this was a clothing optional resort.
All three men laughed, but to Court it still appeared they were regarding him as if he were a unicorn. Robbie said,
Seriously, you aren't going anywhere without a lot of help.
Cliff unrolled a large satellite photo of the area and put it on a table in his hooch. He showed Court where they were in the hills, a few hours' drive south of the highway where he'd been captured.
The FSA has technicals, but you'll need a helicopter. The Iraqi border is 125 clicks east. The Turkish border is three times that to the north.
Court just looked at the army men.
I'll be heading northwest, actually, to Palmyra.
All three looked up from the sat photo. Robbie said,
Now why would a smart fella like you go and do a thing like that?
Court shrugged.
Work.
Cliff said, We've had our drone up north, not to Palmyra, but east over the M-20. We've been seeing all the activity. A couple days ago, the Iranians moved out of the area, then the SAA moved in, and yesterday the militia pushed east along the highway. We even spotted some Russian attack helos. You know anything about what's going on?
Court nodded.
As far as he was concerned, an American A-team right here a few hours' drive from enemy lines should know as much as possible about what was going on.
Ahmed Azam is going to be visiting a small Russian Spetsnaz base, located about 2 clicks east of Palmyra tomorrow, probably in the morning.
What Russian base? The men asked simultaneously, and this surprised Court.
You don't know of a Russian base along the M-20? Cort looked down to the photo and put his finger on the place where he'd seen the nucleus of the security operation. I saw it on an enemy map right here, just north of the M20 highway. Also, there is something they want protected down here. Cort remembered the dumbbell on the map and traced his finger down. There, displayed on the photo, were a few bombed-out buildings and the unmistakable shape of a single runway.
What's this?
It was the Palmyra Airport. It's been shuttered for years, since ISIS came in. The SAA hasn't reopened it.
How old is this image? He asked.
Danny checked the back.
Almost a month. That's so far out of our sector we haven't updated it. Mostly we use our UVAs for real intelligence, not sat images.
Cort's eyes were on the airfield.
Holy shit, he said aloud as it came to him. Not only is that airport back open, but I think the Russians are running it.
Robbie was incredulous.
Where are you getting this intel?
Cort said, can't say, but I can say I'm pretty sure I'm right. Robbie looked at him.
And you want to go there?
I wouldn't say want to, more like have to. Danny said,
shit, sir. I want to be you when I grow up.
Cort shook his head.
You really do not, Sergeant.
Cliff looked to his senior officer.
Hey, Rob, what about hooking him up with the Terp? He's from Palmyra.
Robbie nodded.
An FSA soldier. He's our interpreter. You met him this morning, sort of. He's 100% reliable. The bravest and hardest working kid I've ever met. Seriously, I'm going to adopt the Terp when I get out of here. And he's only a couple of years younger than me.
If he knows Palmyra, then I'd really like to talk to this guy. The Special Forces team's FSA translator was called in over the radio, and he entered the captain's hooch with a very worried look on his face. Cort saw that he was the young man who wore the black Adidas jacket with the white piping that he'd seen earlier in the day. He was in his mid-twenties, with a scraggly beard.
Robbie said, "Meet Slick. He's American. That's all you need to know."
The young man nodded and shook Cort's hand.
Sorry I hit you on the head when you had the bag on. I thought you were Desert Hawks Brigade.
No hard feelings, Cort said. Why is your English so good?
My father grew up in the UK, then moved back to Palmyra. When I turned 17, I studied languages at the University of Homs, French and English, but only for 2 years. Then came the war.
Robbie said,
Slick needs to go somewhere in Palmyra, high up enough in a building where he can see this area here.
He pointed on the photo to where he'd been told by the stranger that a Russian base had been erected.
You know a way to get there?
The Terp furrowed his eyebrows.
It is very dangerous. Maybe if you sneak across the desert you can get there, but the SAA is all over Palmyra since they took it back from Daesh.
Cort said,
Sometime tomorrow, Ahmed Azam himself will be 2 clicks east of Palmyra. I want to be close enough to see him.
An astonished look crossed the Syrian's face. Thinking a moment, he said,
Maybe we can get into the hills to the north. You will be able to look down onto that land. It's very flat.
Cort shook his head.
They will be ready for that.
This base will have berms and structures built up to protect against that high ground to the north. There's no way we can set up there and expect to get a good look at Azam. He spun the map around and put his finger on a point to the west.
But if we can somehow get into the city of Palmyra, they won't be expecting eyes on them from that direction.
The Terp said, Of course they won't. Why would they? It's full of SAA and pro-regime militia units. I have friends who live in Palmyra. I lived there for 3 years, fighting for it myself, before we lost it to ISIS. Then SAA came and took it from ISIS. Trust me, nobody knows the place like I do. But the FSA can't go into Palmyra.
Maybe not the FSA, but what about a couple of idiots with a long rifle?
The Terp looked at the green berets as if he did not understand. Cliff said, I think he's talking about you and him. The young Syrian looked back to Cort like he couldn't believe the American was serious. Cort looked down at the area on the photo, checked the scale, and then touched a building on the far eastern side of the city. It was the only building of any size in the area. The next group of large structures was 3 blocks west.
This building here looks like it's about 1.5 miles from the center of the camp, assuming it's where I think it is. Farther to the runway.
He looked up at the others in the room.
I want to go to this building.
The Terp puffed his chest out a little.
I am a proud fighter of Usud al-Sharqiyya.
Kort looked at Robbie. What's that? Robbie said, Lions of the East Army. It's the name of his militia. I thought he was FSA.
Slick, there are 30 different groups that make up FSA that I know of.
Kort addressed the young man again. Okay, you are Lions of the East. What's your point?
My point is that I have no fear. I will go with you, Mr. Slick.
Kort nodded at the young man. I appreciate it. Cliff spoke to Kort now.
I can gear you up unless you were looking for a cold beer or a bottle of scotch.
Kort shook his head.
You got an M107?
He was speaking of the Barrett M107 anti-materiel sniper rifle. Cliff shook his head.
Negative. But we have a TAC-50. The FSA has one as well.
The Macmillan TAC-50 was another 50 cal sniper rifle.
How pissed will the FSA sniper be to give his up?
Robbie said,
My command says to get you whatever you want, but no U.S. forces are to accompany you when you leave my base. I'll get you that rifle, and I'll straighten it out with the FSA.
Good. Other than the sniper rifle, I need an AK with a folding stock, a pistol, a technical, and some water. Fuel to get me 50 clicks.
The Terp shook his head. Others will want to come.
We have to keep this small scale. If we're detected, either we'll be killed before Azam comes, or they'll cancel his visit.
If we are bringing a truck anyway, it doesn't matter if we are 2 men or 6 men.
You have anyone in mind who might tag along?
The Terp looked to Robbie.
Yusuf and Kadir, plus a driver and a man to protect the driver.
Robbie said, Yusuf and Kadir are the Carl Gustav team.
Kort knew a little about the Carl Gustav recoilless rifle, but not much. He did know that it was an 84mm weapon that fired an array of standard and rocket-boosted munitions.
Trained by you guys?
Yep. U.S. Army ordnance, given to the FSA along with training. Those two guys are as accurate as you'll get in all the FSA. They've been together for years as an RPG team. We outfitted them with the Carl, and now they are rock stars around here. If you need a piece of armor hit at up to 400 yards, Yusuf and Kadir are the ones to do it for you.
Sure, Kort said. That might just come in handy.
Chapter 67. Two Mercedes Viano vans, each carrying a driver and 6 passengers, arrived in Athens, Greece in mid-afternoon. They parked in a lot near the port of Piraeus, and then Malik, Drexler, Sauvage, Medina, and 3 of Malik's men walked along Kostaro Street, while the rest of the GIS men did their best to melt into the neighborhood without being noticed. Soon Drexler and his entourage turned into the doorway of an office building by the water, and they climbed 3 sets of stairs to a large office space overlooking the yachts in the marina. The sign on the door read, Hellenic Carriers of Ocean Freight, Inc. It appeared to be a working office, but a key had been left under a mat for Malik, and when they all entered through the door, the lights were off and no one was inside. Malik turned to Bianca after flipping on the lights.
Mademoiselle Medina, there are a few cubicles in the corners with some privacy, and there is a large corner office that is at your disposal if you would like to rest. I am sorry this is not more comfortable for you, but this office is owned by my department, and it is the closest and safest place near the marina. We will stay here until the boat from Syria arrives early tomorrow morning.
It is fine, of course. Shukran, she said.
Bianca sat down in an office chair and idly looked over some brochures, reading about the services of the freight forwarding company written in French. Malik saw her interest and said,
This is a front of ours. We use this place to help get weapons and supplies into Syria past the embargoes. I don't think the war would be going nearly so well for us without this office, and others like it in Italy and Croatia.
Drexler had been standing by the window looking down on the neighborhood below. Soon he asked Malik to join him there. The Swiss operative said,
You can't keep all your men here. They will stick out like sore thumbs. It is my job to protect Medina until she gets on that boat tomorrow. And you will have failed if someone calls the local police to tell them 10 Arab men wearing jackets are standing on the hot streets at a port in southern Greece. Think, Malik. Medina can only be hidden here for the next 12 hours if we remain low profile.
What are you suggesting?
I am suggesting you send all your men home. Between you, me, and Sauvage,
We can watch her. When the skiff from the ship lands tomorrow, there will be more GIS men to protect her all the way to Syria. Malik looked down at the port, then shook his head. Not all of them. I'll send some home, but I'll keep my top three men here with me. Drexler nodded. Thank you. Malik turned to him. The policeman. You haven't armed him, have you? Armed him? If I armed him, the first person he'd shoot would be me. Drexler smiled now. Don't worry about him. He's my problem, and I'll take care of him. And this was true. Drexler was not worried about Savage. Now he was only worried about the four men between himself and Medina. Malik and his three men. He'd managed to thin the herd by talking the Syrian operative into releasing most of his force here, but the four who were staying, Malik included, would be the best of the best. He knew he could kill four men in most circumstances, but these were no ordinary men. Certainly he would be killed if he tried. He told himself he was just missing one piece to the puzzle, and then he would make his play. Drexler and Malik left the office to go down to the marina to make arrangements for the boat to dock the following morning, so Savage, Medina, and the three Syrian GIS men remained in the large office space. Bianca and Savage sat across from each other at different desks, both with a view out the window to the port, and then beyond to the Aegean Sea. The three security men took up watches in different parts of the sprawling office, leaving Savage and Medina effectively alone together. Bianca recognized this as an opportunity, and after several minutes to ensure no one was close enough to listen in, she looked over to the French police officer.
I've been sitting with you in a van for over a day, and you've barely said a word.
Sauvage seemed surprised that the woman spoke to him at all. He shifted in his chair uncomfortably.
I don't have much to say.
How do you fit into all of this?
Again, Sauvage shuffled in discomfort.
I am just happy you have been rescued, madame.
That doesn't answer my question.
No? Well then, if you must know the truth, just as you were a captive in Paris, I am a captive now. Drexler has involved me in all this, and I came along unknowingly, until it reached the point where I could no longer walk away.
Bianca said,
I am sorry.
Sauvage looked at the woman a long time. Bianca smiled at him a little, and he looked away.
You shouldn't be sorry. This isn't your fault. It's mine.
Bianca checked the Mukhabarat officers on the other side of the room to ensure they couldn't hear her. Then she said,
This European, Monsieur Drexler, he wants me dead, doesn't he?
Sauvage looked down at the floor.
Why would you think that?
She didn't answer him.
And since you just admitted he was the one who got you involved in this, I guess that means you want me dead as well.
Now Sauvage looked up to her.
No, of course not. I haven't wanted anything that's happened in all this. I wanted money for a vacation house in Nice for my kids' university days.
He shrugged and sighed.
And a little more. A lot more, I guess. I was a fool, but I am not a murderer.
What is your first name?
She asked. He looked at her again, nervously now.
Why does it matter?
Because I would like to know.
It's Henri.
Perhaps, Henri, you and I can help each other.
Sauvage looked away once more, out the window and towards the harbor. He stood up, ready to move farther away in the office.
Je suis désolé.
I'm sorry.
Attendre.
Wait.
Listen to me. I see good in you, Henri. You are not like the others. I know you don't want to have anything to do with this.
Henri shifted on his feet now, kept looking out the window, but he did not walk away. Bianca said,
You must ask yourself why you are here.
I am helping them get you to safety in Syria. Since I am a police officer, I have credentials they need in case...
Don't be ridiculous. You must know they have you along for another reason. And when they are done with you, Drexler will kill you. Think about everything you know about what's going on here. Why would men like Drexler and Malik allow a man with that knowledge to return home. Ever.
Savarge sat back down slowly. Soon he put his face in his hands. Bianca said,
No! You must remain strong. We must help each other, if either of us is to survive.
How are we to survive?
That depends.
Depends on what?
Savage asked. The Spanish woman looked him over a long time.
On whether you are brave enough to fight for your life.
Chapter 68 Court Gentry wore a threadbare gray t-shirt with a black track jacket zipped over it, brown cotton pants and tennis shoes. He'd gotten the clothes from FSA fighters here at the outpost in the hills, and with these clothes, he looked just like most anyone else here, even though word had spread around camp about the new visitor. He donned a chest rig that carried his AK magazines, but no body armor. Few of the guys in the FSA had plates, so he opted to go without himself, in case he was spotted by someone close enough to notice he wasn't outfitted like the others. He'd taken the dressing off his head. The 14 stitches over his ear were holding, and the wound wasn't visible through his hair without really looking for it. He went through his gear one last time before departing. He had a large backpack full of equipment, food, and water on the ground next to him, a worn Beretta M9 pistol in good working condition, and an AK-47 with iron sights and a folding wire stock. He wore the pistol on his belt, and the AK lay on the ground next to his pack. All this he considered extra equipment, because his main weapon for this mission lay cradled on a cushioned case in front of him. It was a Macmillan TAC-50, a 57-inch rifle that fired the 50-caliber Browning machine gun round. Court didn't know the TAC-50 at all, but he'd hit living targets in the field at over 1 mile distance with 50-cal sniper rifles, and he'd spent the last half hour with the Terp and the FSA sniper who operated the gun to ask specific questions about the weapon and the scope attached to it, so he'd know how to best employ it when the time came. He'd been given a laser range finder and notes on the ammunition, the air density in the region, and other relevant data that would make it possible for him to hit a 1 to 1.5 mile shot. He zipped up the camel case, slid 3 10-round box magazines into pouches on the outside of it, and slung it over his back on the right side, slinging his other pack over his left shoulder. The AK he carried in his hand, and then he struggled forward to the pickup truck waiting for him at the edge of the camp. Captain Robbie Anderson met the American a few yards from the waiting vehicle, already loaded with 5 Syrians. The vehicle would take the sniper, the Terp, and the two-man recoilless rifle team to a spot in the desert a few miles from Palmyra, and then the Terp and the American would go on alone to the northwest, and the Carl Gustav team would head due north. The technical driver and the machine gunner in the cab would return to base, while the 4 men on foot would spend the nighttime hours doing their best to remain undetected as they infiltrated the security cordon to get as close as possible to where their target was due to arrive the next day. Court shook Anderson's hand, and the younger man said,
Good luck, Slick. If this works, you're going to be famous.
If I become famous, a black helicopter is going to land right here and pick you up for a conversation. Robbie nodded at this.
My lips are sealed. Same as the other guys. I just mean, if you actually do it, you will be making a hell of a difference around here.
Court looked out over the hills and down to the desert in the distance.
Who knows?
He gave a nod to the other Green Berets standing near buildings higher on the hill, then turned to leave.
Any chance you'll tell me your name? I'd look you up back in the States. Maybe we could grab a beer.
Court smiled.
Let's keep this a one-night stand. Trust me, you won't respect me in the morning anyway.
Court slapped the younger man on the shoulder good-naturedly, then began lumbering down the hill towards the pickups. The stranger Robbie called Slick had climbed into the technical, and the vehicle had just begun to roll out behind the others when Danny walked up to Robbie. Both men watched the FSA truck disappear around a bend in the hills. Danny said,
I hate to state the obvious, but that dude is a dead man.
Robbie shrugged.
Yeah, probably. But can you think of a better way to go?
Got me there, Captain. You think he understands this is a suicide mission?
I think that man understands the odds,
and understands what's at stake. He figures his life is a worthy trade for a shot at taking down a monster. The two men turned and began walking along a switchback that climbed up the hill. They'd have to heighten their defenses for the next couple of days, because if the FSA technical was caught in the open and any survivors were taken, it was a good bet someone would come looking for their tiny outpost in the desert hills. Court sat in the bed of the Toyota Hilux pickup with the Terp next to him. Both men had handheld radios with earpieces, and these had also been given to the Carl Gustav crew and the driver of the vehicle. All four men spoke through the back window to the driver about their route as they picked their way across the rough ground. The Terp had a good map of Palmyra, so he and Court could make even more detailed plans about the ingress phase of their operation. The Terp knew of a tunnel Daesh fighters had used when they owned this territory a year earlier. According to the young interpreter, the tunnel attached to the sewer system in Palmyra, and it extended outside the city to the south, connecting with an irrigation canal there that had brought water to farms ringing this ancient city out in the middle of the desert. The Terp asked the other men in the technical while they traveled, but none of them knew if the sewer system or the pipes that ran into the fields had been damaged, destroyed, or filled in. Still, Court decided heading to the farmland south of the city seemed like it might be the best way to get a couple of men close to and then inside the city itself without being seen. After 3 hours driving across open desert, Court and the Terp's technical stopped in a deep channel created in a wide alluvial fan. All four men on the operation climbed off the truck, grabbed their gear, and took a reading with both the GPS on Court's watch and a compass. By their calculations, Court and the Terp had 3 hours walking ahead of them to reach the farmland, and from there, it would take another 1 to 2 hours to get into the city of Palmyra itself. Court said,
5 hours carrying gear and hoofing it, kid. Can you do it?
Of course. Can you? Yusuf and Kadir had just as much equipment, but their walk would be shorter, because they would find a hide site on the eastern side of the supposed Russian base. Court and the Terp said goodbye and good luck to the others, then headed off to the northwest across the alluvial fan, towards a point in the distance they could not yet make out. Kadir and Yusuf heaved their heavy equipment on their backs and went north, planning on finding a layup position as close to the area as possible without compromising themselves. Chapter 69. The dishes were piled one upon the other. There was the breakfast egg soufflé dish, then the lunch croquet monsieur dish, and now Vincent Voland placed the green salad and onion soup dishes on top of the rest. Voland had purchased all three of the day's meals at the cafe downstairs from his office, and he had devoured all three of the day's meals at his desk. Now that it was 7 p.m., the thought occurred to him that he should clean up his mess, lest the rats he often heard in the attic above him find the courage to risk coming down into his office in search of the source of the scents. Just as he rubbed his eyes, breaking the staring contest with his monitors so he could get up to go wash his dishes and return them downstairs, an automatic email popped up on his screen. It was a potential facial recognition hit on Drexler's image. He'd received a half dozen of these so far this afternoon, and none had played out, but he still felt the tingles of anticipation as he blew up the file and the picture loaded on his screen. He looked at the picture carefully to orient himself, and then he rubbed his eyes again, possibly for the 100th time of the day. A group of people walked along a sidewalk in front of the window of some sort of shop. The camera that took the image was apparently positioned across the street, but it was a small road, and the light was perfect for photography. Voland zoomed in on the people, and the software cleaned up the resolution.
Mon Dieu, he said.
The man in the tan sport coat with blonde hair was Drexler, no question in Voland's mind. Next to him was Malik, and next to him was an unknown man of Western appearance. Behind them were three dark-complected and dark-haired men, close enough to where Voland could tell they were all together. And there, right in the middle of the entire entourage of men, was a tall and thin woman with long black hair. He zoomed on her. Bianca Medina looked even more tired and fraught than she had the last time he saw her, but she was very much alive. He had no idea how he could have missed her leaving with the Syrians the other night on the driveway,
but he was elated that she had not been killed. Volan's hands shook as he clicked the file to read the details. The image came from a camera at a travel agency on Kostarov Street near the port of Piraeus, the location where the cargo ship caught smuggling into Syria had picked up its contraband nearly a year earlier. He went online, his hands still trembled with excitement, and he found a non-stop Aegean Air flight from Charles de Gaulle leaving in an hour and a half. Flight time to Athens was 3 hours 15 minutes, and before Voland had even checked what time the flight was due to touch down in Greece, he was out the door of his office with phone, briefcase, and passport in hand. He had contacts in Athens he could call, and he could get them to canvass the area around the port. If Drexler and Malik had not left with Bianca for Syria already, then he would damn well know about it when they did try to leave. Chapter 70. Court and the Syrian, known as the Terp, thought it would take 3 hours to make it across the strip of desert and into the farmland just south of the city. But 5 hours after setting off on foot, they still hadn't arrived. They had a lot of good excuses for their slow advance. Rolling Syrian Arab army patrols to the southeast of the city, small temporary outposts, BMPs and trucks, and even a T-72 tank sandbagged out in the desert with an entire platoon of infantry encamped around it. Upon seeing the T-72, the Terp admitted he'd never run into that sort of defensive setup before, and this just gave Court more reason to believe Azam would show up near the airfield the next day. The mobile patrols were sporadic, but even these, the Syrian said, were more prevalent than he'd seen in the area, especially this far away from population centers. The two men had to go to ground several times while vehicles passed, but with the wide expanse of desert around them, it was difficult for anyone with a light on their vehicle to sneak up on the two men on foot, so Court and the Terp managed to remain undetected. After dealing with the tank and the patrols, they spent a half hour lying flat in a low wash as a pair of Mi-24 attack helicopters circled high overhead. The FSA soldier couldn't tell if the helos were Syrian or Russian. Both nations used the Russian-made Mi-24, but Court worried the Russians might have thermal equipment on board that would make them easier to see if they were up and moving around, so they remained small, flat, and still. After the helos moved back to the north, the men climbed back to their feet, reorganized all the gear on their bodies that had been displaced when they hit the deck, and began walking again. It was past midnight when they entered the trees and farmland just south of the city. It was like an oasis to Court. The air smelled better. The cool of the night felt better with the moisture off the plant life. But more than anything, the chickpea and lentil fields and the rows of trees that grew alongside them made it easier to move without too much worry of long-range spotters in the city seeing them approach. They arrived at the irrigation canal and found the tunnel supposedly dug by ISIS when they were under siege by the SAA. Court shined a tactical flashlight into the hole, and even though the beam stretched out for 100 yards, it still ended in blackness. How far to the tunnel attaches to the sewer? The Terp admitted he had no idea. I thought you said you knew this town. Even when we were fighting here, we didn't live in the sewer. Once we get into the city, I'll show you what I know about the area, but this part right here, I don't know. It looks tight. Maybe we should just stay above ground. Court shook his head. We'll just take it slow, turn around if it gets too tight. Court went first and began crawling through the tunnel with his small tactical flashlight in his mouth. The two men spent a miserable, arduous, back-breaking hour below ground, but when Court and the Terp finally did find a place to climb back to the surface, it was easier than he'd expected. Court had envisioned a heavy manhole cover that would have to be pushed away, or rusty metal bars of a storm drain that would have to be prized apart, but instead, the men simply climbed up on a pile of rebar and concrete rubble where an aerial bomb had impacted the street above the sewer line, and they emerged into a darkened neighborhood of seemingly abandoned buildings. There was no light or movement on this street, and at first the Terp did not know where he was. But when he climbed totally out of the sewer and struggled with his cramped muscles and heavy equipment to move down to a nearby intersection to look for street signs, Court could barely make out that the young man was waving him forward.
When Court showed up a minute later, encumbered by his own various weapons and packs, the young man took him over to the stoop of a ruined building to sit down. The Syrian man said,
"Okay, I know where we are. Not far from the eastern edge of town."
"Good.
There will be SAA patrols, but no one else will be outside. Better we use rat holes to move, so no one sees us on the street."
"Rat holes?
I'll show you."
The Terp stood and entered the building next to them, and Court followed along, still slowed by his gear. They climbed two flights of stairs, past a silent family of seven living among the ruins, and then continued on through the building. Court expected they'd have to find a way back downstairs, but to his surprise, the Terp took him down a long corridor, which ended at a wall with a man-sized hole in it. The Syrian said,
"This is a rat hole. When the Syrian army was in the street, we broke holes in the walls between the buildings so we could travel through the city without going outside. You can cover an entire city block without having to expose yourself."
"Great," Court said. "How many blocks do we have to cross to get to where we're going?" The Terp pulled out his small map of the city, oriented himself, then looked up to Court.
12.
Court sighed.
"Christ, are you kidding?"
"I'm sorry. The damaged sewer means we're farther away than where I thought we'd be."
Court was pissed, but at the situation, not at the kid. He said,
"Let's move out."
The Terp looked the older American up and down.
"You look pretty tired. You want to rest for a few minutes first?"
Court was exhausted, but he figured he'd have time to rest once he got where he was going.
"I want to be in position before daylight. We have to push on."
Chapter 71. In the top floor offices of the Athens Freight Forwarding Company, Malik sat outside on the balcony, speaking on the satellite phone to the men on board the ship on its way into the Aegean Sea from Syria. Inside, his three remaining men rotated watches and rest. Bianca slept on a small sofa in one of the corner offices, and Henri Sauvage sat at a desk by an open window and smoked morosely. Sauvage hadn't seen Drexler in the past hour, so he was surprised when the blonde-haired man appeared in the dim light of the room and sat down in a swivel chair in front of him. He then rolled the chair around the desk, positioning himself at whispering distance from Sauvage.
"I don't have long to explain, but you and I are in a difficult situation."
"Of course I know that. You put me here."
"Perhaps I did, but I can assure you one thing. Right now, I am your best chance for survival."
"What do you mean?"
"When we get down to the dock in the morning, the Arabs plan on killing us."
"The Arabs do?"
Sauvage asked. Bianca had all but convinced him that this was Drexler's plan. But Drexler said,
"Yes, I found out through a source inside the Syrian Mukhabarat."
This sounded like utter bullshit to the French cop, but he played along.
"Why?"
Drexler shrugged.
"Loose ends, you and me. But there is something we can do to save ourselves."
"I'm listening."
Drexler looked around to make certain no one was around, then reached down to his right ankle and pulled out a stainless steel revolver with a black grip. Sauvage blinked hard when Drexler turned the small weapon around in his hand and handed it over.
"What? What is this?"
Sauvage asked.
"Tell me you've seen a gun before." "Of course I have. I mean, why are you giving it to me?"
"If we went after the four men right now, we'd be slaughtered. They are separated around the entire office. They are all armed with submachine guns, and as soon as we got one man, the others would be on guard. But tomorrow morning, we will all walk together to the marina. You and I can walk apart from each other, try to lag back behind the Arabs a few meters. Then, I will pull my gun to shoot Malik. You kill the two men closest to you. You must not hesitate. One bullet into each man's back. I'll take Malik and then whoever is left."
Sauvage was deeply mistrustful.
I don't know.
"Once we get on the ship, we are dead men.
We have to do this to survive."
"What about Bianca?"
"What about her?"
"We let her go. I won't be returning to Syria knowing they have targeted me for termination. She can do whatever the hell she wants.
She can get on that boat, or she can stay in Europe. There was much here Sauvage did not take at face value, but the fact that Drexler had just handed him a loaded gun caused him to doubt his earlier thoughts that Drexler was planning on killing him. If so, how would Drexler know Sauvage wouldn't just shoot him last? The little snub-nosed revolver carried 5 rounds, after all. He gave Drexler a nod. The Swiss man went over the timing and the order of the action again, and then he drifted off into the darkness of the office. Sauvage looked down to the pistol in his hands. None of this made sense to him at all. Bianca Medina had finally fallen asleep on the sofa in the corner office, and she'd dreamed of her son. She'd planned on taking him to the ocean for the first time in his life this summer, and in her dream, she was there with him, and it was warm and wonderful. He'd turned to her, and he'd called her Mama, and she'd smiled when he spoke, and then she started to speak back to him, but she could not say a word. She tried again, but her mouth would not move, and Jamal looked at her with suddenly frightened eyes. She tried to scream now, but still, she could not open her mouth. Bianca opened her eyes to darkness, but she felt the presence of the man over her, his hand pressing hard against her mouth. It was Drexler, she just knew, and he'd come to slit her throat in her sleep. She reached up to swing at him, but a hand caught her hand. Her eyes focused on a face that came down close to hers, and she realized it was the face of the Frenchman, Henri. Bianca went limp as her heart pounded.
Écoutez.
Listen, he said.
You really want to fight them?
She swallowed hard, blinking away the tears of panic.
Yes.
Then I'm with you.
He took his hand off her mouth, and she recovered quickly.
You are? Good.
She sat up in the darkness, and he sat next to her on the sofa and waved something in front of her. It was a small revolver. Bianca gasped in surprise.
Drexler gave me this. He told me the Syrians are going to try to kill me and him both just as soon as we get on board the ship. He wants me to shoot 2 of them as we walk to the marina. He will kill Malik and the other.
But I don't understand. He just handed you a gun?
Sauvage nodded.
He did.
Then he opened the cylinder and dumped out the 5 bullets. He fished around in them for a moment.
These 2. They were the ones in the cylinder next to fire when he handed it to me. These are live rounds, .357, very dangerous.
He held up the other 3 bullets now.
But these 3 cartridges have been opened and the gunpowder has been removed. The primer is intact, the bullet is back in the casing, but the weight was just slightly off, so I checked them. Drexler doesn't know it, but I worked in the ballistics lab at La Crime for 4 years. I can tell if a bullet is real or a dummy round.
Sauvage smiled now.
He wanted me to shoot both men in the back, 1 round each. Then he would kill Malik and the final Syrian, and then, when they were all dead, he could turn his 17-shot Beretta on me and on you. And there would be nothing we could do about it.
Sauvage reloaded the pistol, taking care to put the 2 live rounds back in the cylinder so they would fire with the first 2 trigger pulls. He then slipped the weapon under his shirt at the small of his back.
What do we do? Will you shoot him?
Not with the revolver. We need his help killing the others, so we go with his plan. But you walk close to him. When I kill my 2 men, I will try to get 1 of their weapons. But to do that, I will need time. A few seconds. You must grab Drexler, stop him from killing me before I kill him.
Bianca nodded at this.
I can do it,
Sauvage said.
For both of our sakes, I hope you can.
Chapter 72 Court Gentry lay on his belly perfectly still, looking through the wreckage of a destroyed and empty pet shop on the ground floor of a large apartment building and out into the street. The view ahead of him was not what he wanted to see. The scene was entirely too vivid. Now that dawn had broken, the light of the morning would make crossing the next street next to impossible. The young man Court called the Terp was a few feet ahead. He'd taken off his equipment so he could move with more dexterity, and was all the way up at the doorway in the front of the shop, chancing a lookout at the street whenever possible. Rolling patrols of Syrian Arab Army vehicles passed by at regular intervals. The Terp turned back to Court, 30 feet away, and made some sort of motion. But even though the dawn had broken outside, here in the pet shop that had no pets, it was still too dark to see. When the Terp's gestures became more emphatic, Court took off much of his gear and moved forward. As soon as he crawled up next to his partner, both men had to move out of the doorway as a single BTR-50 armored personnel carrier rumbled by. When the rumbling ceased and the vehicle disappeared from view, Court looked to the Terp.
"What's up?" "The building you wanted to use, it's not there."
Court looked ahead. They were near the far eastern edge of Palmyra, but the going had been painfully slow over the past few hours, and they'd only now made it to within 3 blocks of their intended destination. But when Court looked across the street, over the low buildings there, he saw nothing to the east other than the top of a distant pile of rubble that had once been the 7-story structure he'd wanted to use as his overwatch position. It was less than half the height it had been before.
"Shit," Court said.
He was so fucking tired and sore and scratched and bruised from his hours of crawling and climbing through the rat holes, abandoned buildings, and rubble of Palmyra. The Terp said,
"We can move 2 blocks to the south of where we are. There might be some taller buildings to the southeast."
Court shook his head. "Too much light to keep going. Even if that building were still intact, we'd never make it across open ground to get there." He took the map from the Terp and looked at it with a penlight. "This building we're in now, it looks pretty big. How tall is it?" The Terp had no idea. The two men went back for their gear. Then they crawled back to the rear entrance of the pet shop, made their way down the hallway that made up the ground floor spine of the building, and began climbing the stairs, slowly, very slowly, because both men were exhausted. 15 minutes later, shafts of morning sun shone through holes in the wall, as Court and the Syrian interpreter climbed the last of the broken staircase to the 6th floor of a 7-story apartment building that had been half destroyed by shelling and bombs. Court walked down a hallway that sloped where the floor had suffered a partial cave-in, and then he crawled on his hands and knees the last few feet to make his way into a room on the eastern side of the building. Here, he saw that the entire eastern wall of the apartment was missing, so he was able to look out onto a wide vista with the sun rising over it. He saw that they were 3 blocks from the far eastern edge of the city, and all the buildings in front of him were significantly lower. He peered out beyond the edges of the city, but it was too far away to make anything out. If the base was out there, the shot he took at Azam now was probably going to be 300 or 400 meters farther than he'd planned. But there was no way he could get any closer. He turned to the Terp, who was just crawling off the slanted hallway and down into the room.
"You did great, kid. This is a good hide, but we are a lot farther from the base than I want to be."
He found a dark corner in a back hall near a bathroom, and he sat against the wall, facing the opening ahead. He put down his AK, his backpack, and his rifle bag, and he leaned back against the wall, finally allowing his body to rest a moment. Instantly, his body began cramping.
"Water and salt, kid. As soon as we're set up, we both need to hydrate."
The Terp peered out into the morning light.
"Are we supposed to see a Russian base from here?"
Court lay on his stomach now, pulled his Zeiss binoculars out of his pack, and stabilized them on his backpack. Through the 20-power magnification, he began scanning the desert floor to the east. It took him just seconds to see a Russian Mi-8 helicopter hovering over a large cluster of low buildings, all surrounded by concrete fortifications, wire, and other bunkering material.
"Got it."
He pulled out his laser rangefinder.
2,752 meters to the center of the base.
At 1.71 miles, this was a full quarter mile farther than any shot Court had ever attempted. But he knew it was within the capabilities of his weapon, his ammunition, and his scope. Scanning around the distant base some more, he saw Russian military vehicles, mortar and rocket positions, men going about their day, and a second helo resting on a dusty pad. The young Syrian's binoculars weren't as good as Court's, but through them he scanned to the southeast.
"You were right about the airport. Take a look."
Court did so, and he saw a second base-like development just off the runway, far from the shattered airport terminal. This base was much smaller, but it was fortified with several armored vehicles, and four Russian military helicopters were parked on the sandy tarmac. A pair of Kamaz Typhoon MRAPs, or mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, also sat in the center of the base. Court knew these big transport vehicles were used in Syria by Russian Spetsnaz Special Forces units. Only by carefully scanning the desert floor and the highway that bisected it here, could Court see more infantry, more armored BTR-wheeled troop carriers, and an assortment of big trucks and smaller military utility vehicles. It appeared to Court that at least two companies of regular Russian infantry were here, which was interesting, because he thought this was supposed to be a Spetsnaz or Special Forces base. Clearly the area had been augmented with additional forces, and this meant to Court that something special was going on. Next, both men worked on their hide. Court pulled out the TAC-50 and set it up on its bipod, and he put his AK-47 within reach on the floor next to him. Now that he had his 35 power scope on his rifle to use to sight on the base, he gave the Terp his 20 power binoculars, along with a security sector to keep an eye on, and then he went back to work on ranging in his rifle for the approximate distance he'd be firing from later. The young man asked, "Should we check in with Kadir and Yusuf to make sure they are in place?" "Not yet." The Motorola military-grade handheld radios the men carried were encrypted, and their range was over 30 miles. Still, Court had ordered the other team to stay off them until he transmitted, except in extreme cases. He was less worried about the transmissions themselves being picked up, but he knew it was always possible the transmissions could create an electronic signal that could be identified as an unknown force in the area on UHF, and the Russians could thereby determine they weren't alone. He looked at his watch. "It's almost 7 a.m. No idea what time Azam is coming, but you can be damn sure we will see him when he comes." Court didn't say it, but he was worried that seeing the Syrian president was all he would be able to do. He was just too damn far to feel confident in his ability to hit a man-sized target. Court opened up an MRE packet of red beans and rice, which was full of the sodium he needed since he'd been sweating away salt for the past 12 hours. While he ate, he drank an entire bottle of water, and he made sure the young Syrian did the same next to him. While the Terp ate rations, he looked at Court a long time. Finally, Court said, "I'd rather you didn't stare at me."
"Sorry. You don't look like the other soldiers I've seen."
"No."
"No. What is your unit?"
Court spooned some rice into his mouth. "I'm with a unit that doesn't feel the need to tell everyone about what unit we are." The Syrian seemed to think this over.
"I don't think I've ever met anyone from that unit."
Court smiled a worn-out smile at this. "Tell me about you, kid. How did you end up here?"
"I'm the idiot who agreed to come with you."
Court smiled again.
"You've been hanging around smart-ass Americans too long."
The Terp chugged water, then said,
"As I told you, I was in the university in Homs. I started going to the protests when they were peaceful, just singing songs and stuff. But the protests got rougher. People started throwing rocks at the police, and the police started shooting back. Some of the students managed to get guns. I was against that, but what could I do? Soon enough, the protests turned to battles, but I refused to fight. The Mukhabarat picked up my brother, said he was a ringleader, but I don't believe it."
"He never came home."
The young man looked off into the distance as he recalled those days.
"I had done a year in the army when I was 18, but by then I was 21, and I'd driven a tractor when I was in SAA, so I didn't know much about fighting. Still, when Mohammed didn't return and my mother's and sister's hearts were broken, I decided to join the resistance. I wasn't special, just another rebel fighting in Homs and Palmyra. But when the Americans came, they needed someone to translate."
"What will you do when the war is over?"
The young man gave Court a strange look.
"When the war is over, I will be dead."
Court glanced at him a moment, then crawled back to his rifle scope to scan the Russian base.
"You don't think you'll live through this?"
"No. I will die shahid. You call it a martyr."
Court just sighed, and the Terp heard the noise.
"You don't want to be shahid?"
"I'll let some dumb son of a bitch on the other side be a shahid."
I don't understand.
Patton, Court said. General Patton. That was his line. Well, sort of.
This did nothing to rectify the young Syrian's confusion. Who is that?
I'm just saying that if you go into a war ready to die, then you're probably going to die. And if you die, then the other side wins.
Of course, but I know that Allah can take me at any time.
Court took his eye out of the scope and looked at the Syrian.
You think you could ask him to wait till I'm done with you?
The young man smiled.
It does not work that way.
You guys talk 5 times a day and you don't get to ask him for stuff?
The Terp laughed.
You are a Kufa, a non-believer.
Court shrugged. A non-believer thinks they have all the answers. That's not me. I don't know what's out there beyond my ability to see. All I know is that I don't know. And I do know that a hell of a lot of people in this world are dead set on killing each other over stuff they seem so damn sure of.
Yes, my country has been crying blood for a long time. My friend, we share the same destiny. You and I are going to die like everyone else.
Court scanned to the south again, at the airport. There were no fixed-wing aircraft in sight, which he found interesting. He said,
I don't plan on dying till I kill at least one more asshole.
Azam?
Can you think of a bigger asshole around here?
No. He is definitely the biggest asshole around here.
As he finished saying this, Court took his eye out of his scope and looked out at the blue sky in front of him. Off his right shoulder, an airplane came into view, flying low, its gear down. Court recognized it as a Russian Yakovlev Yak-40, an old but trusty transport jet. The Terp said,
The airport is open.
In the sky above it, both men saw a pair of MiG-29 fighter planes circling. These were not preparing to land, but they were clearly protecting the transport. Court said,
And a VIP has arrived.
Do you think it's Azam?
We've come a long way, so I'm shooting whoever gets off.
The Terp said,
I like this plan.
Court reached into his backpack and took out 3 liters of water. It was all he had left.
Kid, I need you to pour this all around the floor and on the walls, 3 meters in every direction.
But why?
When I shoot this gun, it's going to kick up a lot of dust. If we don't wet the area, I'll have to wait for follow-on shots.
Court added, We won't have time for that. The young man opened the first bottle and began pouring it on the floor, sprinkling it on the walls around him.
Chapter 73. Just before 7 a.m., Bianca stood with the 3 Syrian GIS men, their leader Malik, Drexler, and Henri Sauvage, inside the door to the office building. The ship from Syria was just offshore, and a skiff would be arriving in the marina shortly to pick everyone up. Malik was on his phone, talking to a man on the skiff, and she could hear him coordinate the exact location for the pickup. Malik slipped the phone back into his pocket and turned to the group.
We want to arrive at the dock at exactly the same time the launch does. It's still dark. We do this right and no one sees us.
Drexler looked out the window, then back to Malik.
Let's go. What are we waiting for?
The Syrian Mukhabarat operative shook his head.
We have a minute to wait, so it is timed properly.
What the hell does it matter if we get to the water a few seconds before they do?
Malik just shook his head.
My operation, Drexler. My rules.
Drexler wiped sweat off his brow. Vincent Voland parked his rented Toyota Yaris 4-door compact on a hill just a block away from the camera that had recorded the sighting of Bianca Medina, Drexler, and the Syrians the day before. It was not yet 7 a.m. He'd come straight from the hotel after his late-night flight and his early morning check-in, and he'd just spoken with the 2 watchers he'd hired to keep an eye on the port and told them they could go home for a few hours' rest. His men had seen nothing, so Voland worried the Syrians were no longer in the area. Voland needed more rest himself, but he was too wired to sleep. He figured there was little chance he'd see Drexler and company walking around the dock, and that he'd probably already boarded a ship. But as soon as the offices at the marina opened up, he'd start pumping the workers there for information. In the meantime, however, he wanted to walk the area to get a feel for the location. He walked along Akdi Kandili, where the images had been taken, and then he went down to the water. An occasional car drove by behind him, but this was near the closed private marina, so there wasn't much going on this early in the morning. He turned to go into the city a few blocks, to try to get a feel for where Drexler and his entourage had been coming from on their way to the port, because